Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and you're listening to The Current. Well, it is a spring-like morning on Bowen Island, British Columbia. Down at the marina, another ferry rolls toward shore, carrying passengers from the mainland. We are on land where cars are whizzing along Bowen Island Trunk Road, shuttling people to and from the dock. And that's where we find 66-year-old Edward Watchman. He is waiting on the side of the road, trying to hitch a ride. He doesn't bother putting out his thumb. Instead, he stands under a white metal sign that reads, "Lift Stop." 1 minute passes, then another, and another, until...
Hi there. Where are you going?
I thought I'd go out towards Mount Gardner. Are you going that way?
I'm going up to Adams Road.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
For you?
Sure.
My name's Edward, by the way.
Hi, Edward. I'm Denise.
Do you pick up people much?
If it's kind of a Bowen Island thing, if you see somebody standing by the side of the road, obviously they're going somewhere. Do up your seatbelt, please.
Sure.
Safety first.
Yep. Got it.
Do you live here on the island?
Yeah, I live down Miller Roadway.
Oh, okay. Terrific.
Thanks for the lift.
Hey, no worries. Happy to help.
Two perfect strangers brought together by one free ride. It sounds a lot like hitchhiking, but on Bowen Island, they call it Bowen Lift, as in linking islanders through friendly transportation. Rosemary Knight is one of the people who helped start the program. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna Maria.
So there are no thumbs involved here. Edward was standing at something called a lift stop. What is that?
Well, a lift stop is relatively new on Bowen Island, but I have to say, hitchhiking, giving and getting lifts with and from neighbors is not new on Bowen Island. In fact, it used to be hard to go for a walk down the road on Bowen Island without someone stopping and asking you if you wanted a lift. Lift stops ensure that we have safe places, safe pullouts for cars along the roadways, and that's what the lift stops are all about.
As they stand there, are they wearing something around their necks, aren't they, to kind of indicate...
Well, that's a different part of the Bowen program. The Bowen Lift program really has two components. First, we took a map and we color-coded the island into eight areas. Blue Water is blue, Hood Point is gray, Kate's Hill is orange. Then we developed this system of mirror hangers and lanyards. And that helps with the matchmaking that needs to happen between those with the cars who can give lifts and pedestrians who are getting the lifts. So you hang the mirror hangers in the cars. That tells the pedestrians generally where the cars are going. Then the lanyards are badges that can go around pedestrians' necks, and that tells drivers where on the island the pedestrians are going. And it wasn't so much for use with the lift stop. The real motivation for this mirror hanger lanyard system was our ferry. People who travel on the ferry without a car, and we'd like them to be able to find rides to and from the ferry. So this system of mirror hangers and lanyards will help foot passengers connect on the ferry with cars going to their neighborhood. They can go down and walk around the car deck and look in the windows and find a mirror hanger and talk to the driver.
Couldn't they just hop on a bus?
We could hop on a bus. We do have a bus service. But the fact is it's very limited in terms of hours of service. So there's no midday bus. And the last bus is at 7 o'clock. And there are parts of the island that are not covered. Bowen Island has such a high ratio of kilometers of road to number of people that public transit will just never be a cost-effective way to meet the need. And so Bowen Lift is seen as a way to complement the bus service that we do have.
How concerned are you that it involves people potentially taking rides from strangers and the risk that that might imply?
Well, Bowen, giving and getting lifts, I think if you talk to most people on Bowen Island, we don't see it as strangers jumping into cars with strangers. It's really about neighbors connecting with neighbors. And then it's important to realize, as your interview on Bowen Island showed, this is not new on Bowen. People have been giving and getting lifts from neighbors for a long time. And then the point that this is a completely voluntary program. On the lift signs, there's language making it clear that it is your choice to give or get a lift.
Okay, so you have these two components. How much support are you getting for this on the island?
Well, the Bowen Lift Program started, there were four of us at a meeting in 2010, and we started talking about transportation needs on Bowen. So we started with very little funding, and the four of us, we got funding from one of the groups on the island to develop our first round of mirror hangers. But we just didn't have the funding we needed to really get the visibility that we needed on the island. We have 3 lift stops currently. We're hoping to have 20 lift stops. So what we did last summer was applied for and received a grant from Environment Canada's Community EcoAction Program. And the majority of this funding is going to be used to prepare safe pull-off sites, our lift stops around the island. And we're hoping the visibility that will give us and new mirror hangers, the lanyard program, events on the ferry will give us a higher level of visibility and just get people back to doing what has always been an integral part of living on Bowen Island, getting lifts from neighbors.
If it's always been a part of it, why do you have to formalize it?
Well, some of us have noticed that over the last 5 to 10 years, with more people moving to the island, it's getting harder for those people hitchhiking to actually get picked up. And we started noting that fewer people were hitchhiking. And so we looked at this and said, wait a minute, we're a small, friendly community of 3,500 people who tend to know their neighbors. We really have to get this ride sharing, giving and getting lifts from each other, back to being a central part of our community. It's a great way to meet people on the island. I see ride sharing and hitchhiking really as a great litmus test for a community. Do you feel comfortable giving lifts? Do you feel comfortable getting lifts? So I'm convinced that the more it's done on Bowen, the better we get.
Are you someone who's hitchhiked much before you got this started?
In my 20s, I hitchhiked around New Zealand. On Bowen Island, I do hitchhike. I'm very comfortable hitchhiking. We live on top of a hill fairly close to the village. And while I walk down to the village, I think in 16 years of living on top of that hill, I've never walked back up. I always just stick out my thumb as I'm walking, and I've always got a lift.
Your experiences have all been positive?
Yep. My experiences have all been positive.
Do you think
I don't
this
hitchhike
would...
Oh,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't hitchhike in Vancouver. I did once because I ran out of gas and was walking along with my jerry can, and a woman picked me up, and I think she was more concerned about picking up a hitchhiker than I was about getting a lift at that point. And she said, you look pretty safe, the jerry can and the briefcase. I wasn't too concerned.
But it seems like this is more about an island culture than a city
it's
culture.
It's definitely Bowen Island, and that's why this works. So that aspect of Bowen Lift, I really think, is appropriate for Bowen Island. We looked at our community and said, how can we leverage who we are? And so that's what Bowen Lift is all about.
Rosemary Knight, thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Rosemary Knight is one of the organizers of the Bowen Lift Program.
Message 114, new. From an external number.
Hi, my name is Steve Paul. I live in Millbrook, Ontario. I'm 67, and I've been hitchhiking for over 50 years. When I had to put my motorcycle away in a garage some distance from my house, so I was hitchhiking home, and a guy picked me up, and we had a great chat along the way. He was a recent immigrant to Canada from Hungary, and we had a great time talking about his homeland.
Message 115, new. From an external number.
Hi, my name is Anita Lewis. I'm calling from Toronto, Ontario. The first time I hitchhiked, I was in France. I needed to get to Cognac. So with this other girl who was from the States, we hitchhiked. And it just seemed so easy, and it was pleasant, and it was a truck driver.
Your mailbox is almost full. You have 10 new messages.
My name is Lance Tomlinson. My location is Smooth Rock Falls, Northern Ontario. And my story about hitchhiking is about a man I picked up about a month back. As we drove along, he told a story of being mugged in Toronto. And when I picked him up and heard his story, I dropped my friend off. And then I took him back out to the highway where he could catch a ride. And I gave him $20 and told him to get some food into him and wished him the best of luck.
Well, there we go. We invited your stories of hitchhiking, and as you heard, they filled our mailbox. I think that might be our quote of the day. I needed to get to Cognac. Okay, clearly a popular way to get around, but the signals used by hitchhikers have varied over the years, from outstretched thumbs to signs reading moose jaw or bust, and now mirror tags and lanyards, as they have on Bowen Island. But Bowen is not the first to formalize the practice. Call it what you will, slugging, instant carpooling, or anonymous ride sharing. A new brand of hitchhiking is hitting the road, and there is no extended thumb required. For more about this, we're joined by Alan Pisarski. He is a transportation analyst and the author of a book series, Commuting in America. He is in Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
What goes through your mind as you hear that evolution of hitchhiking?
It is an interesting history. As cars were fewer back, let's say, 50 years ago, they were kind of a prize, and so a lot of people would share the vehicles with other folks. And over time, as that's changed, as the car has become more ubiquitous, and I think maybe people a little more nervous about each other, we've drifted away from that. And it's unfortunate. It's probably those extra seats are probably the biggest wasted resource we've got in transportation.
Well, tell us about Washington's slug lines.
The slug lines started up many years ago, and they have a very specific attribute. That is that we have special lanes that are reserved for cars with three passengers in them. And so, in effect, getting that third passenger can be very important because this trip on these special lanes can save you 15 or 20 minutes in terms of travel time. When I first moved out to the suburbs, I was actually suitors coming to my door inviting me to join their pool. And this became organized over time where parking lots began to accumulate places where people would stop, usually next to the bus stops where people stood around, and you'd just pull up and invite people off of the bus stop line to join you in the HOV lanes. And over the years, it developed into a very sophisticated culture in many ways where there's unwritten rules about how you how you behave in somebody else's vehicle.
Such always, as?
Well, you don't speak until spoken to. You don't smoke. You don't. The driver doesn't play the radio. You don't ask for special stop. Would you drop me off here? Kind of thing. There's a whole family of rules.
No, but this isn't regulated. This is the informal.
Absolutely not. Okay. Absolutely not. It began totally informally. And began to acquire some formality in the sense that local governments were willing to put up signs that say, "This is on this corner is where people congregate to go to the IKEA parking lot down on I-95 South."
Well, how do people know who they're picking up, though?
They don't. I think it's a little bit like Bowen. There's a kind of a culture here. A lot of this grew up because the Pentagon, with a lot of the military folks, is at the head of I-95, and so a lot of these people were military. But as it moved to downtown Washington, to Roslyn, which is a small suburb of Washington, still a lot of government employees. Instead of the Bowen tag, you've probably got a government ID, or you may be wearing a uniform. So I think there is that kind of comfort level, if you will, that permits people to be a little more sanguine.
Okay, now, are there other examples of hitchhiking in other cities that you've seen elsewhere, either in the States or in the world?
More limited. California started it again because of people getting over one of the major bridges in San Francisco, and that if you had three people in the car, you rode free across the bridge. And so people would, in effect, rent themselves out. They'd stand on the corner and make themselves available to join a carpool, and that would get everybody across the bay faster.
So these are all things I was going to say driven by, but pardon the pun, but yeah. Seriously, driven by the need to commute faster.
Yes, and very often it's access to a high occupancy vehicle lane. And this is one attribute, and this is what I've kind of called organized hitchhiking. It's slightly more organized because, like the Bowen folk, where they've decided that they want to set aside an area where cars can pick up people and both can do so safely. But there's a third category I think that we're seeing more and more of and will see more and more of, and that I think we could call automated hitchhiking, with the whole new world of electronic gadgetry apps that people can have in their cell phone. We're seeing more and more people kind of sharing a ride, using the technology to both identify an origin destination that helps them, but also to vet the people who are getting in the car or the people whose car you're getting into.
So in other words, you can go online, check someone out, or sign up.
You go to YouTube, you go to one of the others, and you click this person's name, and you find out that he's been doing this for 12 years, and he's a lovely person.
So why is this happening? Is this because public transit isn't good enough? Why?
I think a large part of it is just the ubiquitous nature of travel today. People are going from so many origins to so many destinations. It's not the typical pattern of a kind of a pipeline where you're lived at the head of one end of the pipeline and are going to the other end of the pipeline, which transit can serve very well. But if you have suburban patterns, circumferential travel rather than downtown-oriented travel, it's a lot easier, I think, to expect to be able to make this kind of a connection. A lot of it comes from the universities, for instance, university towns where very frequently students don't have cars, are not allowed to have cars, and I think that's kind of one of the areas of substantial growth.
Alan Pazarsky, thanks for your insights.
My pleasure.
Alan Pazarsky studies transportation and public policy. He is the author of a book series called Commuting in America. We spoke to him from Washington, D.C.
Message 114, new, from an external number.
My name is Jim Bloom, and I'm located in Calgary. I was hitchhiking from Southampton to Cardiff to visit my uncle and was picked up on the last leg by a man driving a Triumph TR4 sports car. As we entered Cardiff, we got stuck in traffic. To my surprise, a large blue-clad arm reached into the car through the open roof, turned off the engine, and removed the keys. We were surrounded by police, and I made the rest of the journey locked in the back of a police van. It turned out that the driver had stolen the car earlier that day.
To go to the next message, press 6.
Hi, my name's Catherine Evenden. I live in New Hamburg, Ontario, and I have a hitchhiking story. It was 1982, and I had just started out on a year's travel in Europe with a friend. So we got into the back of this vehicle, and they shut the door on us, and it was quite dark in there because of no windows. And as we looked around, sitting on the ground, we discovered that there were weapons all over. We were wondering how we were going to get out of it. We looked up at the guys, and they looked kind of weirdly dressed. We talked about where they were going, and they were actually going to a castle on that Sunday morning to do a battle reenactment.
Who knew? The appeal of hitchhiking is obvious. But over the years, the dangers associated with it have been difficult to ignore, given the murderous rampage of Clifford Olson and the murders and disappearances along the Highway of Tears. Linda Mahood has traced public attitudes toward hitchhiking in Canada. She's a history professor at the University of Guelph. She's writing a book about hitchhiking in Canada in the 70s. And Linda Mahood joins me in Toronto. Good morning.
Hello.
It's fun to watch your reaction as you listen to all of these calls. How have attitudes toward hitchhiking evolved in Canada?
The history of hitchhiking in Canada is similar to what's been described. It was essentially developed by little boys in the 1920s for the novel experience of getting a ride in a car or for a quick way to a fishing hole or a baseball diamond. During the wars, picking up a serviceman was a gesture of patriotism for most Canadians. And for the most part, picking up a woman with a bag of groceries or a waitress in her uniform or a defense debutante or a schoolgirl with a armload of books was an act of chivalry. But things seem to have changed in the 1970s. By the 1970s, just following the wave of early baby boomers who hitchhiked across Canada. And I should add that in the Globe and Mail in the early 1970s, they forecast between 50,000 and 300,000 young people were going to be hitchhiking through Winnipeg. So it was a big fad, if we don't have a better word than that. And a lot of journalists traveled along with the kids, and they reported in the local newspapers what was going on, and it, using those neutralizing techniques, put people's mind at ease.
Well, in fact, in the Trudeau era, didn't they actually have some kind of a federal program enable hitchhikers?
Yeah, it enabled hitchhikers, or at least prevented all these young people from sleeping on the road. There were urban legends that arose around Wawa that, you know, with 80 kids sleeping in the ditch in a night. One story is that a guy was stranded in Wawa for so long.
Wawa, Ontario. The one with the big goose, right?
Yeah, that's the one. He was stranded on the Trans-Canada so long that he married a local waitress. That was the that was the joke. But anyway, so there were so many kids doing it that the Trudeau government decided, Gerard Paltry decided they needed to do something, and they implemented a youth hostel program so that young people could sleep in the armories and not on the sides of the road. That didn't go well, and so they did youth hostels instead.
So when did the popularity of hitchhiking begin to wane?
It seems to be waning just as that bubble of the baby boom moves through university. By 1974, the press are no longer so excited about a hitchhiking story, and the reports are very much about young girls in particular leaping from vehicles, raped at knife point, missing, parents pleading, we knew she hitchhiked, but we don't know where she is. There was a lot of stories. In the mid-70s, there was a TTC strike.
In Toronto,
a 33-day strike. And by this time, social scientists have been looking at where sexual assaults take place. And it seemed that during that period, the number of sexual assaults remained the same, but they were 9 times more likely to happen in cars.
Well, and it's interesting. I mean, I did point out the Clifford Olson story, who picked up young people along the roads, and also Highway of Tears, where we know young Aboriginal women have no other way to get back and forth and have disappeared in large numbers. How much has media coverage of such stories shaped our views toward hitchhiking?
I think it's done a great job. I mean, hitchhiking in the 1930s was exciting. There was contests. University students would hitchhike to see how fast they could get across the country. In the 70s, it was neutralized. But by the mid-70s, the attitude seems to change. It's one of danger. And I think that it's important to understand that hitchhiking, the stories are great. Most rides are by really generous people who want to share their resources. But the car is more than just a mode of transportation. Culturally, our cars have a meaning and a significance, and they're a private space. Sex and cars go together in our understanding of it. They were called brothels on wheels originally in the 1920s. Mm. And in the intimacy of the car, the freedom of hitchhiking becomes constrained. And yeah. People aren't necessarily free to get away.
Well, you lose control, huh? Listen, I have a clip for you. The RCMP do not keep specific statistics on hitchhiking-related crime, but researchers at the University of Northern British Columbia are investigating hitchhiking in the region in the Highway of Tears area. This is a clip of Jacqueline Haller, an associate professor at UNBC.
First of all, there's no doubt from our results that hitchhiking is or can be a risky activity. So people have told us about scary experiences ranging from, you know, feeling uncomfortable or receiving inappropriate remarks all the way to really terrifying events where people were held against their will. But I do know that some of the people who are participating in our study feel strongly that, you know, that's a risk they'll take, particularly, and I want to emphasize this point, in the absence of really good transportation alternatives.
Linda Mahood, would people still hitchhike if they had access to better public transportation?
I think some people would, but I think the idea of hitchhiking is that the profiles that were done, the psychological profiles, is that the hitchhiker is an adventure seeker, an autonomous individual. And so there's a kind of person who will always take that kind of risk. But I think it's a big risk to expect people who don't have cars to take.
And I'm wondering, when you hear about the Bowen Island program or other things, apparently there have been suggestions that the SLUG program be used in Calgary as well. What do you think of those more formalized programs of sharing rides?
Well, it's essentially the same soup, different pot. But I understand with Bowen Island, they were creating sort of a carnivalesque feeling around it. And behind this carnivalesque feeling is certainly the sense of surveillance. People know their neighbors. There's a good chance that if something goes wrong, somebody will see you, somebody will report it, and we have a cell phone. But I think anonymous hitchhiking in urban areas where people don't know each other is sort of depending on a kind of nostalgia. for a time that doesn't really seem to exist anymore.
What kind of experiences have you had hitchhiking?
I hitchhiked around Saskatoon in the 1970s with my friends, and then I joined Katimovic in 1978. And the only rules of Katimovic were three: no hitchhiking, no drugs, and no sex.
Did you break the hitchhiking
rule? We all broke the hitchhiking rule.
I won't ask about the other rules, but as you interviewed other people for your book, did you find that they had good experiences or?
I've done almost 100 interviews in different ways. Most of the experiences are absolutely fine, but there's a dark side that comes out, male and female, right down the line equally. And it's essentially about 80% have had some experience that was uncomfortable, if not violent.
Fascinating. Linda Mahood, thanks for coming in. Linda Mahood is a history professor at the University of Guelph. She's writing a book about hitchhiking in Canada in the 70s, and she was in our Toronto studio. That's our program for today. Stay with us on CBC Radio 1. Q is next. Tonight at 10 o'clock on CBC Television, watch The National. Now, coming up tomorrow, we have a special web exclusive. According to the UN's most recent human development rankings, countries in the Southern Hemisphere are on the rise. And tomorrow, we'll post my interview with Helen Clark, the UN's third highest ranking official, and you can find out what she has to say about what the rise of the South means for the global balance of power. So we'll post that at noon when the embargo on it ends, and that will be at cbc.ca/thecurrent. We're going to leave you this morning with one more hitchhiking story from Daryl, one of our listeners who called in. I am Anna Maria Tremonti. Thank you for listening to The Current.
Message 115, new. From an external number.
Well, I guess it was over 30 years ago, and I was working as a helicopter pilot. I had the job of ferrying a helicopter from Quebec out to the West Coast, and I was not too far out of Montreal, flying kind of low, and I saw a young couple standing on the side of the road with backpacks, and I'd heard from some other friends of mine in the business that from time to time they picked up hitchhikers, and I thought, well, this is going to be a long trip. Maybe I'll give it a try. So I landed, and they somewhat reluctantly, after a little bit of waving, the young gentleman wandered over, opened the door, and asked them what they were up to. And he thought I was the police, but I told him that I wasn't. I asked him where they were headed. He said they were out west, they were on their honeymoon, and they were on their way to Banff. And I said, well, hop in. It was a little bit of an incredulous response, but they did, and we flew to the Banff where I dropped them off. I got cards from them from time to time over the years, but lost touch over a number of moves. So that's my story. My name's Daryl, and bye-bye.